ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I had to get stuff for my neighbours. I've already got my kit ready.
I went through Cyclone Tracy, and so it's good that people are aware and that they're trying to do things. That is really good. They're not disregarding the notices.
Oh, I just bought a portable radio for myself, a battery operated. Last one.
Darwin is officially on cyclone watch, with tropical cyclone Fina now forecast to pass between the Northern Territory capital and the Tiwi Islands on Saturday. We'll head to the Tiwi Islands shortly to hear how they are preparing. And our cemeteries are an important final resting place and memorial for those who've died. But they are also providing habitat refuges for rare and endangered plants.
These cemeteries could be 150 years old. They were set aside for the purposes of a cemetery, but they also preserve nature, and the nature has been, it hasn't been harmed in being a part of the cemetery. So the native ground cover, the grassy layers are all intact.
I'm Alex Hyman, and this is Australia Wide. But firstly, residents along the NT coastline are preparing for a rare November cyclone to make landfall on Saturday. By cutting down tree branches, stocking up on goods and making decisions about where to bunker down. Northern Territory authorities are urging residents to prepare for strong winds and potential flooding. With Cyclone Fina predicted to pass over parts of the Tiwi Islands north of Darwin in the coming days, preparations are well underway in local communities there. Heidi Dawn is the Deputy Chief Executive Officer of Tiwi Islands Regional Council. Heidi, how are people feeling there as Fina approaches?
Look, everyone's in good spirits, to be honest. Everyone's pitching in to get what we need done to ensure the communities are cleaned up and safe. You know, there is still a concern, obviously, in the air with, you know, the unknown. We can read the charts and the data and try and prepare as much as we can, but it's still the unknown is still making people a little bit nervous.
What sort of conditions are you being told to prepare for?
Definitely extreme rain and extreme winds. And then we've got, at the same time this storm surge is coming through, we are experiencing a high tide at the same time. So definitely talking about the low-lying areas across the communities and how that storm surge will increase those high tides, obviously being a fairly low-lying area, to really start to consider about the potential of a flooding on top of the pouring rain and the wind. So,
when did the community last face a cyclone there on the Tiwi Islands?
They haven't had one for a number of years now. There's been a lot of potential ones with lows in recent years, but they haven't seen one for a number of years. So, yeah, it is new especially for kids and the likes that they haven't experienced this. So there is a lot of talk amongst kids on preparing them and ensuring that they understand the risks of, you know, going out, swimming in drains and you know, potentially of trees and power lines being down. So a lot of education is going on right now to ensure that if we do get hit in all communities, that we ensure that we provide all the information to keep everyone safe, especially during that cleanup phase.
I understand there are no cyclone shelters on the island. What have previous storm events taught the community there about preparedness?
Yeah, look, the cyclone shelters is on everyone's mind at the moment because it's one of those things that you don't think about every day. You don't think that you know, especially during the dry seasons and things like that. So it's only when you start, you know, preparing if a low is predicted, then everyone, you know, the talk starts again. So we need to ensure that after this, the talk doesn't stop. We keep talking about in all three communities that we don't have that safe haven. We don't have somewhere to send people if the cyclones come through and do intensify. So we need to keep that advocation going of we don't have a cyclone shelter. We don't have anywhere to send the vulnerable people, the nursing homes and people like that. So it's in the back of everyone's mind. Everyone's trying to stay positive, but we definitely need to start talking to all levels of government so we don't have to worry about that in the future.
And today, have there been any evacuations from the islands for some of those vulnerable members of the community?
Yeah, so the first community that will potentially be in the line of the cyclone will be Millicarpety. So evacuation discussions have started over on Melville Island side to start identifying the vulnerable people and start discussing with them whether they do want that evacuation. So that will start in the next 12 hours to start getting vulnerable people back into Darwin into some safe spots. And then the other communities will be in discussion in coming hours if it does keep intensifying and looking like it's coming through the Tiwis. So at the moment, that discussion hasn't started for Bathurst Island because we will experience it second, here. So that's definitely to not have to disrupt people from their homelands and take them out of community to know that we've got a cyclone shelter in the future. Yeah, obviously the Tiwi people are very family orientated, so to have to split people up and evacuate some and not all to have a cyclone shelter will be, a game changer over here.
And what population are you dealing with, are you managing there across the Tiwi Islands? How many people are we looking at there?
Got around 3,500 people across both islands, so three major communities and then some outstations, homelands as well. So Bathurst Island, Warrinyanga, is definitely the biggest island with about 2,500 people here. And then you've got Perlengimpi and Millicarpety on Melville with about 500 or so each, and then people out on homelands as well.
And how robust is the power and communications infrastructure there?
Look, we're hoping it sustains, but we do have a number of blackouts regularly just with the age of everything out here. So your central services officers are going to be working flat out to try and help the community as much as they can. They're prepared, the diesel, the chainsaws, everything they possibly can to eliminate what they can, but it's time will tell. Look, we've got really great people working really hard to ensure that we do everything we possibly can to prepare, and then some plans definitely in place for recovery and cleanup after.
And what do you expect those challenges may be once FINA has passed?
A lot of tree cleanup. We've got a lot of trees in community. We've been trying to clean up as much as we can with branches and low-hanging branches around power lines. But that's probably our biggest concern, is ensuring that we'll work hand-in-hand with ESOs to assess power lines, assess the different branches that are around, because we do have some concerning trees in the communities, and then work from there of the cleanup, whether it's removal, whether we need linesmen to come in and assess the cleanup first. So,
and how are supplies looking there? I know there have been some pictures in Darwin of some empty shelves in some supermarkets in Darwin. How are the supplies going there in the Tiwi Islands?
Yeah, look, we've been very lucky on the Bathurst Island side. So Warrinyanga did receive a barge delivery this morning, so very grateful to receive that. Whether you have bought groceries from mainland, they would have been delivered on the barge this morning, and the two shops on this side would have received their stores as well. So unfortunately, with the marine warnings, the barge didn't make it around to Millicarpety. So we're in discussions with them to ensure that if there is anything before the rain does come in, whether we can get it up to them by road. So we'll be in communication with them multiple times a day to see if there's anything they do need. But unfortunately, they didn't get their delivery just through the barge day and the marine warning sort of lined up. So look, I think everyone's a bit of a sigh of relief, the fact that we did get that barge delivery in today and know that we can be fairly self-sufficient for a coming week or so. So,
and Heidi, just to finish up, what's your message for the community for the coming days?
Look out for your family, your friends, and I know the Tiwi people will, because that's in their nature anyway. But really, communication, understanding where your friends, your family are. Take shelter if you don't think you're in a house that's, maybe structurally where it needs to be. Seek refuge with friends and family to ensure that you are safe. Reach out if you need anything, and just stay safe. you know, we need to keep this discussion going after, definitely to advocate for some funding for some cyclone shelters, just to give these Tiwi people a peace of mind in the future.
Heidi Dawn is the Deputy Chief Executive Officer of the Tiwi Islands Regional Council. All the best for the coming days, Heidi, and we really appreciate you speaking to Australia Wide.
Thank you. Thanks for reaching out to the Tiwis. Much appreciated.
ABC Australia Wide.
And you are with me, Alex Hyman. It's great to have your company here on Australia Wide. To Queensland's Fraser Coast, thousands of retirement dwellings are under construction across the Bundaberg region as the area grapples with Australia's second highest population of over 60s. Lifestyle villages offering resort living and relocatable home parks are among the major developments. The council hopes the projects will ease the housing crisis, but as Johanna Marie reports, with that hope comes concern there are enough support services for so many more new residents.
It's all systems go in the normally quiet seaside suburb of Burnett Heads, one of the coastal communities of Bundaberg, soon to be home to a luxury resort-style retirement village. But walking along the esplanade at Bagara, locals are divided on the development boom.
I think it's a good thing for the region to expand and have new people coming here. Whether they've got the facilities to provide for the retirees is the other thing. That's a bit of a worry. Definitely need new hospital, and we definitely need more specialists here. We're very short on health specialists.
Would a retirement home interest you?
No, I'm a bit old school. They're going to cut me out of my property in a box. That's it.
The federal member for Hinkler, David Batt, says the area is already home to one of the highest populations of over 65s in the country.
So it is bringing people here that are in the prime of their life and then going on to their golden years. So what comes with that is the issues of needing more medical treatment and other issues of as people age, as they get older. So yes, definitely we need more hospitals, more doctors, more physios, all those other services that people need as they get older, and we're struggling to find them in our region.
Gem Life Managing Director and CEO Adrian Pullidge says their project will likely attract migrating retirees.
Burnett Heads is our first community in the Bundaberg Wide Bay region, and will feature 437 homes over three big development stages. So it's a 20.3 hectare site, minutes from the beach in that beautiful lighthouse bay part of the coastal village in Burnett Heads. It's a $323 million project.
Over the past 12 months, the Bundaberg Regional Council has approved 18 separate projects with some 3,600 individual dwellings, varying from over 50s accommodation to relocatable home parks. Mayor Helen Blackburn says it gives people a chance to downsize and unlock existing housing for the wider community.
It definitely does provide that opportunity. So for somebody that might be an empty nester with a five-bedroom home, they could potentially move to one of these five-star type resorts, which is exactly what these retirement developments are. So you can downsize and yet still end up with something that's far better than what you might have now, and that's allowing that housing to be available for other people.
The mayor agrees the growth will put added pressure on the health and aged care sectors.
I've said from the time that I've gotten into office that I have two priorities. One is accommodation, everything from student accommodation all the way through to nursing homes, and increasing the size of our cemeteries. So we need to be looking after everyone right from the beginning all the way through to the end. Nursing homes is on my list, and it is one of the things that I do talk to investors and developers about when they're coming into our region.
Property prices have more than doubled in the region in the past 5 years. The median price in the Wide Bay is now $660,000. REA Group's senior economist Angus Moore believes the retirement projects could potentially cool the market.
What we've seen for Wide Bay over the past 5 years is an enormous growth in home prices because it has been a very popular region for people to move to. Since the start of the pandemic, so a bit over 5.5 years, home prices in the Wide Bay region are up more than double, up 120%. And that's actually made it the strongest growing region across Australia. But building more homes is fundamentally the only way that we will start to improve housing affordability sustainably over the long term. And in particular, building more homes where people want to live, which is increasingly places like the Wide Bay region.
Back on the Esplanade, it's easy to see why it's a popular place to enjoy the golden years.
An easier lifestyle, work, rest, balance. Yeah, just the better life, the better weather. Originally coming from Melbourne, it's bloody cold down there. I just love Bundaberg. It's just beautiful.
Johanna Marie with that report from Queensland's Fraser Coast. A rural town on the New South Wales mid-north coast will be home to a state-first trial next year, offering mental health treatment to patients in the comfort of their homes. But residents and experts are worried the pilot program could be a double-edged sword, with mental health inpatient services set to cease at the town's local hospital. Charles Rushforth has this story.
In the rural town of Kempsey on the mid-north coast of New South Wales, mental health access is getting an overhaul.
A part of the recent redesign that we've been discussing with staff and key stakeholders is around the HIS model, which is a hospital-in-the-home model for mental health services.
That's Sarah Fox, the head of mental health services at the mid-north coast local health district. She says from early next year, the town of 31,000 people will be able to access mental health treatment from their living rooms, with doctors travelling to patients' homes in a state-first trial.
This is a positive innovation for New South Wales Health, and we have the opportunity to be a leader across the state with developing a pilot for the Kempsey area. The HIS model is hospital in the home. This is something that's been in the physical health space for the past 20 years and allows us to reduce stigma and provide more safe care in the comfort of people's home.
But the new model has been criticised by local residents because it means the mental health unit at the local hospital will no longer take patients.
I'm disappointed, I'm offended, I'm shocked, I'm saddened.
Alexandra Wyatt is a councillor with Kempsey Shire Council. She says friends and family members have received life-saving care at the hospital's mental health unit.
It has offered them respite. It has offered them a place to sort of, you know, calm down, to breathe, to be connected with a social worker or a mental health nurse. It allows them to have a good night's sleep, to have a good meal, to not have to deal with whatever is going on at home or out in the community for them.
Councillor Wyatt says she's concerned treatment at home will be riskier than what's available at hospital because it doesn't give patients a chance to move to a neutral environment.
When my family was going through our experience with ill mental health in the early 2000s, it was a stigma that I would never, ever put my hand up and talk about because it was uncomfortable and shameful. But since then, I have used my voice to advocate for change. And what I see in front of me, moving to an in-home hospital bed care situation, I think that's actually high risk. I mean, I'm not a practitioner, but I think that's high risk. And I also feel that in our situation, most likely that could have resulted in a death.
In a statement, the Mid-North Coast Local Health District said patient capacity will be increased at Port Macquarie Base Hospital's mental health unit, 55 kilometres away. The new pilot will also see more funding for community services, including programs aimed at First Nations mental health patients in the town, where 12% of the population is Indigenous. Hospital in the home mental health care has already been rolled out in other states like Victoria and Tasmania, where experts say it's working well. Psychiatrist Patrick McGorry runs a clinic that offers the service in Melbourne.
Hospital in the home is an essential, I would say, adjunct for, you know, residential inpatient care, because it allows quite a few patients who otherwise would need to be admitted to hospital for treatment and for safety reasons to be treated in the home, and patients and families generally prefer that to going into an acute hospital unit. Conceptually, it is meant to be, you know, an equivalent to inpatient care, but the client group or the patient group that can be safely treated in hospital home is only a subset of the total number of acute patients. So in other words, there's still going to be some patients where that's not safe to do that. I'll give you one example. Someone with an acute manic episode with psychotic features would be extremely difficult to manage in the home situation, even with frequent visits. We operate one of these services at Origin, our service in Melbourne, and it's been very successful as an additional program, but we still have our inpatient beds. In fact, we don't have enough of them.
New South Wales Minister for Mental Health, Rose Jackson, says if successful, the program could be rolled out statewide.
This has come up through Kempsey. You know, I thought, great, good on them for having that initiative, for being a bit creative and thinking about how to deliver care. So we're going to respect that. I guess my feedback is, if it does work well, if this is something that the local community feels is really positive, watch this space. And we might look to roll it out more statewide.
That's New South Wales Minister for Mental Health, Rose Jackson, ending that story from Charles Rushforth.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
Around Australia, historic cemeteries have become a safe haven for flora and fauna affected by urban expansion and farming. One species, which has found refuge in an 1850s cemetery in northern New South Wales, is a rare orchid unique to a small patch of the mid-north coast. Emma Siosian has taken a walk around the cemetery with one of the experts who is helping manage the species, who explains why cemeteries are much more than burials and gravestones.
On the outskirts of a small town on the New South Wales mid-north coast, life is blooming in an historic cemetery. Tucked among bushland, the graveyard, more than 150 years old, is home to a critically endangered ground orchid, the pale yellow double-tail. It was first discovered at the site in the mid-1990s, and since then, the Mid-Coast Council has carefully managed the area to ensure the orchid species is protected.
There's only three or four sites where we know this species occurs, so it's really limited, extremely restricted in its range.
I'm here at the graveyard site with the council's senior ecologist, Matt Bell, who regularly monitors the orchids.
Yeah. The orchid does occur in areas that are mown, if they're mown at the right time of the year, when the species isn't flowering. So it really relies on areas that have a native grassy ground cover. So it only appears when it's flowering. So you can only detect it in September or October when the flower spikes emerge. It's the flower spikes are very small. They're only about 20 centimetres high, but they've got a showy yellow flower on them. A beautiful, delicate, complex flower. But it's incredibly difficult to find because it's only obvious when it's flowering and it flowers for such a short period of time.
So what sort of things do you do to preserve it?
So it's essentially protect the flower spikes when they emerge. So it's to safeguard them from trampling or mowing or disturbance. We also look after the habitat, so we treat weeds.
And what happens if there is a burial happening at that certain time when it's flowering?
Yeah, so it's just the spikes are identified, they're flagged so that the operation can take place respectfully and appropriately, but the orchids are protected from any trampling or inadvertent harm. And so we have a long history of where the orchid spikes do occur, and they do occur in and amongst some of the gravestones. So it is a bit of there's a balance there. It's a very difficult tightrope that we have to walk in order to allow people to utilise the cemetery for its purpose, but also to preserve the orchids at the site.
It's one of many places across Australia where historic cemeteries are providing relatively undisturbed habitat for rare and endangered plants and animals. In a rural area of Canberra, the 1883 Hall Cemetery also provides critical habitat for an endangered orchid. It's the only place in the ACT where the Tarengo leek orchid is found. Matt Bell says cemeteries are far more than just a place of gravestones and burials.
Well, cemeteries they're set out so long ago. These cemeteries could be 150 years old. They were set aside for the purposes of a cemetery, but they also preserve nature. And the nature has been, it hasn't been harmed in being a part of the cemetery. So the native ground cover, the grassy layers are all intact, which means that orchids and a variety of species that have been impacted in other landscapes for development and other reasons, they're preserved in cemeteries. So we come to cemeteries to connect to our families and to our lineages and to our society, but we can also come to cemeteries and connect with lineages of nature and biodiversity, which is really special.
Matt Bell says sightings of the rare ground orchid on the mid-north coast have been few and far between this spring, but overall, its numbers seem to be holding steady.
It's erratically flowering, definitely. So, and that presents challenges for us to understand the population, because it's naturally erratic. If there's a declining trend in the number of flowering individuals, that's hard to detect when there's variability. And that variability might be a result of rainfall patterns or other seasonal factors. We're still working out a lot of knowledge about this cryptic and very rare plant.
Emma Siosian reporting there from the mid-north coast of New South Wales. And finally here on Australia Wide, the Monte Cristo homestead north of Wagga Wagga in southern New South Wales holds the unofficial title of Australia's most haunted house. It's long drawn ghost hunters from around the country hoping to catch a whisper of paranormal activity. After being owned by the same family for more than six decades, it's now up for sale.
Overlooking the railway town of Junee, the Victorian-styled manor and its sprawling grounds has a gruesome history and a spooky reputation. It all started in 1885 when Christopher Crawley and his wife Elizabeth turned the property into an 18-room homestead where they raised their seven children. There are tales the family are continuing to haunt the homestead to this day, with some visitors believing they've seen multiple ghosts and others claiming they've seen objects mysteriously moving on their own. Real estate agent Jason Barrett.
One of the stories with the ghosts is that the stairs were bleached. A maid fell from the top veranda and died here on the steps.
As guests enter through the front door, they are greeted by portraits of the Crawleys, who seem to be making sure they get a good look at anyone who dares to step in. But the stunning Victorian-styled interior of the Monte Cristo is enough to distract visitors from the glare of the former occupants, from the decorative wallpaper to velvet drapery and quaint antiques.
It's a pinnacle listing. There's been inquiries across the country from people that are keen to buy it and come back to the homestead. The folklore and the ghost side of it is obviously a big part of it as well. I think the big appeal is that it's fully furnished.
By the time the second owners of the Monte Cristo, Reginald Ryan, and his wife Olive purchased the property, it had been abandoned for more than a decade and on the brink of collapse. The couple did lots of work to restore the home to its former glory, turning the property's history into a gripping tale. Mayor Bob Callow.
To see Reg Ryan come along, the entrepreneur that he was, to rebuild the place in such a way that it became an iconic part of the town, and internationally known. So it's a real boon for Junee. It always has been. And I just hope in the future it can be so again.
And for the past few decades, visitors could book ghost tours in the homestead, or if they dared, stay overnight to immerse themselves in its history. As someone who has lived in Junee for more than 70 years, Gail Common says she's heard many different stories from visitors and locals over the years.
People swear and declare that they've seen things, they've heard things, they've felt something on their shoulder, like a hand or something like that. Not everybody experienced it, but it's amazing the number of people who do think that they've seen or felt or heard something there that is unusual or out of this world.
Mrs. Common says it would be a shame for the entire town if the house lost its rich history.
It really was a big thing, and film crews came, people came from all over the world to see that and to see us, of course. But yes, it's unique. It'd be really sad to see it sold to somebody that turned it into a private dwelling and not had it back to what it has been.
And the mayor hopes any future buyers will honour its iconic legacy and spirit.
The thought of losing this place was absolutely horrific, because people come from far and wide just to come here, and then they go to the chocolate factory or they go to the old roundhouse. And instead of staying here for one day, they stay here for a couple of days. It would be hard for the town if somebody just came and turned it back into a house or a B&B. I'm really hopeful that some entrepreneurial person again will see the value in Monte Cristo and take it on again.
Whoever buys the Monte Cristo will be able to inherit the property alongside its historical value, as long as they're willing to accept the fact that there could be unseen companions who will come as part of the package.
That was Justina Baster reporting from the Monte Cristo homestead that's been dubbed Australia's most haunted home. It's in Junee in southern New South Wales and is now on the market. And that is Australia Wide for this Thursday. I'm Alex Harmon. Thanks so much for your company. Have a wonderful evening. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.